You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of August, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Sophie Grove.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Xenia Dormandy from Chatham House is here to set the news agenda. Xenia, what stories have you got for us?
Three stories this morning. The first is, of course, we can't avoid the story on Egypt and the over 500 killed yesterday by the military. And what should be the international response, or what is the international response? Second story about North-South Korea. Are relations between the two relaxing? Are they getting warmer, or is this just an interim upbeat? And, of course, the economic turnaround going on in the West and perhaps a backward slide in the East.
Excellent stuff. So lots to discuss. Then, is the deadly political crisis in Egypt a wake-up call to the Islamists running Tunisia? We'll be finding out.
And our transport editor, Tristan McAllister, brings us the stories you need to know this week, from the fatal UPS crash to the new 787 issues and Amtrak numbers.
In the period from 2002 to 2011, the actual fatality rate among cargo jet crashes was 8 times higher than it was with passenger jets. So is safety an issue here?
Plus, forget about dining next to crying babies or putting your name on a waiting list. These days, it's all about dining in privacy.
We want simplicity. We want a focus on a particular theme or ingredient, and we don't want overcrowding.
All that, plus we flip through the Italian papers and catch up with our correspondent in Jerusalem. That's all to come in the next hour, right here on Midori House.
So lots to look forward to in the next hour here on Midori House with Sophie and I. But before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Further protests are expected today in Egypt after the crackdown on demonstrators earlier this week. At least 623 people are known to have died when security forces moved to break up protest camps in Cairo, set up by supporters of the ousted President Mohamed Morsi. Egypt's military-backed interim government has said if necessary, it will use force again today. Country's ambassador to the UK, Ashraf Al-Khali, says the Muslim Brotherhood is trying to portray itself as the victim.
We are trying to involve them in the political process. The Muslim Brotherhood are part of the fabric of the Egyptian society, and they are part of the fabric of the political society, and they have to be in the future parliament and in the election. They have to run it the way they want it. And the mediation is targeting this point. We want inclusive parliament and inclusive government.
The United Nations has called for maximum restraint, and President Obama has said the violence must end. The journalist Rachel Shabi, who covers the Middle East, told us the U.S. has done little to stop the killing.
The U.S. is really blundering. The Egyptian army doesn't really need to take it too seriously. When President Obama says that this level of violence is completely unacceptable, the Egyptian army can say, well, fine, but, you know, as long as you're not going to back it up with actual threats, with penalties, with consequences, then we can pretty much do what we like.
Leaked documents suggest America's National Security Agency has broken privacy rules thousands of times over the past 5 years, subjecting U.S. citizens to unauthorized surveillance. The Washington Post has published details of an internal audit leaked by the whistleblower Edward Snowden. It shows the NSA decided not to report the accidental surveillance of phone calls in Washington after a programming error. It was meant to be spying on calls to Egypt. Indian Navy divers have found the bodies of two of the 18 sailors who were trapped in a submarine after an explosion and fire on board. There's been no sign of life since the explosion on Tuesday night as the sub was docked in Mumbai. Libya's prime minister says he's ready to use force to end protests by guards at the country's main oil ports. Ali Zaidan accuses them of trying to sell oil unofficially as they stage a strike over pay. Ministers say Libya has lost more than $1.5 billion in oil revenue because of the dispute. Two senior managers at the New Zealand dairy giant Fonterra have been suspended as inquiries continue into a contamination scandal. It set up two investigations into how bacteria that can cause botulism got into infant formula, which was then sold to consumers. Meanwhile, a strong earthquake has struck just south of New Zealand's capital, Wellington. The quake was of magnitude 6.5, but there are no reports of serious damage. Despite that, it caused panic on the streets.
We sort of weren't sure what to do. We sort of ran out in the end. It was kept on going and going. I'm not sure whether that building is safe or not.
We went under the doorway and then it like didn't stop, and so we just came out here. Got like a heart. It was scary.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Paul Osborne. Well, it's 5 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You are indeed listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Sophie Grove. It's time now to set the day's news agenda with the stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Zainia Dorminy, Project Director for the US program at Chatham House here in London. Welcome to the program, Zainia. Happy Friday. There's really only one story dominating all the headlines in this morning's front pages. Of course, the horrific events in Egypt.
Indeed it is. And I think that's going to be dominating the news for some time to come. Of course, you know, as we know and as you reported, over 500 people killed yesterday by the military when they went into the Morsi supporters' camps, mainly in Cairo, but actually elsewhere in Egypt as well, and almost 4,000 injured. The question that everybody is asking, that you're seeing on the fronts of all the newspapers, is what do we do now? What does the international community do now? And there's a lot of trouble on that. I mean, from the US perspective, everybody is watching the US, seeing their response. Many people also watching the EU, seeing what comes out there. The EU does not have a coordinated response. I read that the Danes have stopped all assistance. The French are asking questions as well. And America is sitting there kind of going, what do we do now? We've got $1.3 billion we give to the military every year for exercises and for cooperation. That doesn't seem to be having any effect. What else can we shut down without actually ruining our bilateral relations that are very important?
Do you think the Americans do have leverage with this government or this military occupation, however you choose to look at it? Because really, you know, this money, how critical is it to their tenure?
The answer is that the Americans have some leverage, but not a lot of leverage. And we see this again and again and again. And this is not just the case in Egypt. And this is not just the case for the United States. $1.3 billion is a big number. But if the Americans don't give it, the Saudis will, or others will. So it only goes so far. And the Egyptians want to do what they're going to do, and they're going to do it anyway. And so you can make changes in the margins. What the $1.3 does do is ensure that the American military and the Egyptian military have good relations. They ensure joint operations. They ensure joint exercises. They ensure that the Egyptians come to the United States and vice versa to train. Those kind of relations, being able to pick up the phone, being able to have conversations, making sure that the phone lines are always open, that actually is kind of important. You can start to change the way people approach problems, think about problems. But it's marginal and it's intangible. And that's where you have a problem. You cut that off, as the Americans did it with Pakistan for over a decade, and suddenly you have a decade of Pakistani military leaders who know nothing about the West.
One man that a lot of people haven't really been discussing yet, but perhaps should be, is the Egyptian-born leader of al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri. There's an interesting editorial today from Peter Bergen. He wrote that Ayman al-Zawahiri essentially has warned that this would have happened. He's drawing back on his experiences in the 1991 incident in Algeria, where an Islamist government was democratically elected and then there was a military coup. Is this a perfect opportunity then for him and al-Qaeda to make a stronghold, perhaps in Egypt?
I think it's a very good question. I mean, you have to remember a couple of years ago when these revolutions started, the common refrain you heard from the West is, you know, al-Qaeda, you know, the people in this region, look, this is what happens when you pursue a democratically, peacefully elected change in government. It is possible. It is possible more using these kind of instruments than the ones al-Qaeda prefers to use. And what you saw was, you know, one after another authoritarian government fall, not through al-Qaeda, but through democratic processes. This is a reverse of that. So, I mean, he's right in a sense. What he's emphasizing is, look, nobody really means it seriously. The authoritarian governments are going to come back. You have to come back to the kind of mechanisms that we're using. So in that respect, it is clearly a negative. On the other hand, you also have to remember that these governments did fall because of a democratically elected process. And what the Americans, what many Egyptians, what many others are trying to do is get that back on track, get that kind of democratic process back on track, which, of course, is the recent events is making that harder and harder. And, of course, El Baradei, interim vice president, stepped down yesterday just saying this is, you know, I can't support this.
And that coalition of those leaders like El Baradei, the head of the Coptic Christian Church, the leaders from the religious universities there in Cairo, they initially, obviously, when they first had the coup, they all kind of stood behind their military leaders there. But now, is that coalition starting to fall apart?
Absolutely. So what you're seeing now is there was some small hope when the coup, not that the Americans are calling it a coup, but when the coup happened, that what you'd see is what Morsi didn't do, which is bring together people from different groups. And the hope had been that, yes, the military's coming in. Yes, they're deposing Morsi. They're apparently now arresting Morsi. But you'd see the military bring together the different groups to create a kind of coalition government, where an inclusive government. That hasn't happened. What is very, very clear over the past few days is the military has no desire for a kind of inclusive government, although, you know, many are still trying to urge in that direction. And that has meant that some of the inclusion, if you will, the El Baradeis of the world, have actually said, we can't support this.
Well, let's turn our gaze to North and South Korea now. Looks like there's some movement going on there. Kim Jong-un changing his tack a little bit. Tell us about that.
Really big question. I mean, I think this is a really important one. We're so fixated by what's going on in the Middle East that we're missing some of the interesting stories coming out of Asia at the moment. So the North and South Koreans agreed a couple of days ago to reopen the Kaesong industrial complex, which is the one industrial complex. It's the one kind of initiative that the North and the South have been working on together for decades now. They closed it back in April due to the ratcheting up of tensions when the North Koreans tested their third nuclear test. This is the one thing, this complex has stayed open through all of the tensions over the last decade or so. It was closed. It's now reopened. The hope is that that's a first step towards warmer relations between the North and the South. The leader of the South has also said that they should reopen reunions between families from the North of the South who haven't seen one another in 60 years. Again, that was closed a short while back, a couple of years back now. Is this a warming of relations that will continue, or is this yet one more reverse in the roller coaster between the North and the South?
But not to be a pessimist, but yes. We have seen this all before. It's this never-ending circle between, it doesn't matter if it's Kim Jong-un or Kim Il-sung, it's this never-ending circle with different administrations in the North and the South, and nothing ever seems
nothing
to really
ever
change.
Changes. Well, one of the a senior American diplomat once told me the North Koreans are the best negotiators out there, because everybody else you can kind of predict a little bit, you know, what they're going to do based on their interests. And the North Koreans have a tendency to shoot themselves in the foot quite intentionally, but actually it works because it means they're unpredictable. You need to give them more space. So is this yet one more unpredictable move, or is this a movement in a positive direction? Big, big question mark after that. But we have to watch it because, of course, you have to remember that North Korea is a nuclear power, and what happens in that region has huge implications more broadly.
Now, as you say, so many events in the Middle East slightly eclipsing other news. Economically, there's some interesting figures out. Tell us a little bit about what's going on in the macroeconomic scene, especially the BRICS.
So this is an interesting one, because actually, if you put all the economic pieces together, you come to a somewhat different conclusion than is what we've been reading for the last couple of years. And I saw this in a piece in the New York Times yesterday. Essentially, you know, the stories that we're hearing is the incredible growth of the BRICS, the decline of the West, economic power moving east, you know, watch this space. But actually, let's look at some of the numbers. We see that China's growth is still high. It's still at 7%, but it is significantly down from its earlier 12%. The Indian growth has gone back to what they call a Hindu rate of growth, you know, at kind of 5-6%. The Brazilians have slowed down. The Russians have slowed down. So all of these countries that have been driving economic growth and this incredible enthusiasm, their growth appears to be slowing. Still decent rates by the developed country world, but nevertheless much lower. Meanwhile, the U.S. economy is back on track. We saw yesterday that the European economy is getting back on track, 1.2% annualized growth for the second quarter. So, you know, the Japanese, big question mark here, but the Japanese, let's be optimistic, are back on track, pulling out of deflation. You know, is this the world turning on its head? Are we going back to seeing strength in the West and weakness in the East?
Well, you mentioned some of those numbers there. China having growth around, they're going to try to at least aim for 7%. Brazil is about 2.7. India, 6.3. So there's still very high numbers. So I guess the economic argument is that as these countries continue to develop and modernize, that there isn't really a way for these countries, as they develop, to maintain 7% growth rates year in, year out. They're going to have to come back to a more normal 3% or something like that.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, you look at the raw numbers and there's no question the BRICS and some of the other emerging countries are still way above where the developed world is, where the West is, where the US, where Europe is, where Japan is. But what you're seeing is much slower growth, you know, a kind of reversal in those very fast numbers. And you're seeing the West, which has, you have to remember, in size terms, are the generally the bigger economies. I mean, China's number two, but Japan number three, Europe playing a strong role there. Large economies growing a little bit faster. Do we need to think about where the power balance is?
Well, Xenia, as ever, great to speak to you. That was Xenia Dormany from Chatham House.
Coming up, we'll be asking if Tunisia is viewing the crisis in Egypt as a wake-up call, so please do stay tuned.
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum-making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? A different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburger Knockel and Kolonskink, a head cheese and a Faluda, tune into the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's the menu, in association with Crew.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time here in London is 8:18. Now, as the crisis in Egypt continues to rattle the region, some eyes are now beginning to shift to Tunisia, a country with the only Islamist government still in power. While opposition groups have asked that a non-party coalition government be created in response to the unrest in Egypt and said that more dialogue was needed to avoid a similar crisis.
But the chairman of the ruling party, Rashid Ghannouchi, has rejected calls for a new government and warned the opposition parties not to even speculate about a possible military coup. So, with tensions on the rise in Tunisia, is it likely the country will go the same way as Egypt? Well, joining us on the line is Fawaz Ghajez, Director of Middle East Centre at the London School of Economics. Fawaz, welcome to the programme. Is it fair to make these comparisons to very different countries, Tunisia much smaller? Do you think that at this point Tunisia should even be contemplating a similar scenario?
Well, yes and no. Yes, because whatever happens in Egypt migrates to neighboring Arab countries. In fact, one of the lessons we teach our students is that whatever happens in Egypt, wherever Egypt goes, the rest of the region follows. Egypt is the most populous Arab state, 85 million people. It's the cultural capital of the Arab world. And secondly, what we need to understand is that the Ennahda party, the Islamist party in Tunisia is an extension of the mother party, that's the Muslim Brotherhood. They're really very similar. But of course, as you said, and also a third point is that the social and political landscape in Tunisia is as divided as in Egypt. So you have on the one hand the secular liberal leaning opposition, on the other hand you have the Islamist, deeply polarized. But of course Tunisia is different than Egypt. Tunisia is a very small country. You're talking about 6-7 million people. Egypt is 85 million people. In Egypt, the army has a history of intervention in politics. It's an interventionist military institution. In Tunisia, the military really has not played such a role throughout its modern history. And finally, another party, the Islamist party in Tunisia, has been much more receptive and willing to build coalitions with secularists and liberals and nationalists, unlike the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So while there are differences and similarities, and the next few days are very pivotal for Tunisia.
And of course, at the center of all this is the work that was meant to be done on drafting a new constitution and election laws. Of course, that isn't happening. When will that go ahead, and do you think it actually will?
It will. It seems to me the major differences that had existed have been mostly resolved. The question really now is not about the constitution. The question is about sharing power. It's about what kind of government that exists in Tunisia. And also what we need to remind our listeners is that the question of politically driven violence. In the last year or so, there have been two major assassinations of two leading secular-leaning opposition. And the opposition basically has accused another party, the main Islamist party, of basically providing the context for the assassinations to have taken place. But the reality is you have extremists in Tunisia, in particular what we call Salafi jihadis, who subscribe to Al-Qaeda's ideology, who have been pouring gasoline on a raging fire and basically carrying out attacks and assassinations against opposition members, and that's really polarizing the situation further in Tunisia.
And do you think that the Ennahda party will look at the example that we've seen from the Muslim Brotherhood and their mistakes in Egypt, the lack of dialogue, but also the Islamic notion of governance, you know, the idea that that has to be the centre of the way that the administration will work? Do you think we might see some moves towards a more secular style of governance?
Well, I mean, this is really what the big debate taking place, not just in Tunisia, in Egypt, in the entire Arab and Muslim world today. Really, I think most listeners will miss the picture, will miss the message. If you focus just on the clash between Islamists and the military and the opposition, the clash is really over the identity of the future state in the Arab world. How civil, how secular, how religious, the role of the sacred in the political process. Really, in this particular sense, it's only by understanding that the clash, the struggle, it's over the hegemony of the future political state in the region. And this is what's happening in Tunisia. We shall wait and see whether, basically, lessons are learned from Egypt. The irony and what's alarming in Tunisia is that some secular opposition members basically are trying to imitate the Egyptian model by saying we need a revolution and we need to call on the army basically to get rid of the Islamists. While the Islamists are saying, well, look, we don't have another General Sisi. General Sisi is the strong military man in Egypt. And I think they're trying to create and build bridges to the opposition. But the reality is the political and social and ideological context is deeply polarized. And that's why it all depends on whether cooler heads will prevail in the next few days and next few weeks in Tunisia.
Fawaz, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. But Fawaz Jurjis, really appreciate you coming on the program. Excellent stuff, as always. Director of the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Well, now it's time to talk a little bit of transport, shall we? Monocle's Tristan McAllister brought a slew of stories you'll need to know this week, from the new 787 issues to the UPS crash and, of course, Amtrak. He spoke with our producer, Thomas Lewis, a little bit earlier.
The Dreamliner has once again been in the headlines. It took to the air again with lots of new protocols and things in place for those behind the scenes to check any ongoing issues. But there seem to be new issues that have emerged. What can you tell us, Tristan?
Right. Well, Tom, we were just getting word today that ANA, which was actually the launch customer for the Dreamliner, they took the first Dreamliner that actually came off the assembly line and was delivered to a customer. They found faulty wiring in one of their jets. It was a defect in the fire suppression system that would have triggered the wrong extinguisher on the wrong engine. Were there to have been a fire in the engine. Other airlines with the jet were notified, and they're not reporting similar things after inspections. Japan Airlines actually turned an airplane around as a precautionary measure. Again, they didn't find anything on that airplane. What I'm sort of curious to know here, Tom, is what line number these airplanes were. We do know that Boeing didn't sell the first six of the airplanes off the assembly line, and that there were many more that were sort of held, because there were changes and modifications that had to be made. So, you know, given that, I wonder if these planes may have been one of those. No one has said that, so that's just speculation. And, you know, at this point, it looks as though that most of the other, you know, 70-something Dreamliners in the air, or at least able to fly, do not have this issue. But again, it's just something to add to the list of things that have plagued the infancy of this this in-service program.
And we'll move now to Alabama, Tristan, where a UPS plane crashed as it missed the runway in Alabama. Is the latest in a series of crashes for cargo planes. What can you tell us about the situation that unfolded on Wednesday?
Well, we haven't learned all that much yet. I think a lot of it is hearsay from witnesses who are actually in the neighborhood, in their homes, very nearby when this plane hit the field shortly before the runway yesterday morning, as you said, in Birmingham, Alabama. It did kill both pilots. We're just learning the names of those pilots, although they've not been confirmed by the airline. We're just hearing that sheriff's departments and other agencies are saying that these were, in fact, the people on board. No one else on the ground was injured. What's interesting here is the number of cargo plane fatalities in the last 10 years. In the period from 2002 to 2011, the actual fatality rate among cargo jet crashes was 8 times higher than it was with passenger jets. Now, the interesting thing here is it's not that the planes are different than the ones that commercial passenger carriers are using. So is safety an issue here? And I think that's one of the things that the NTSB, the FAA, and then, of course, EADS or Airbus will clearly be looking at in the investigation of this crash, because I don't know that we mentioned it was an A300F cargo jet.
And as you say, that investigation from Alabama is still ongoing, but are you getting any sense of how security procedures might be swinging into action to look at this and to actually look at the broader issue of why so many fatalities seem to be taking place involving cargo planes?
Well, if you look at the list of the actual incidents that involve cargo jets recently, it's everything from unsecure, improperly secured cargo, so weight shifted. We had that incident outside of Bagram Air Base where the 747 literally fell out of the sky because the cargo supposedly shifted as it was taking off. I mean, there's that incredible dramatic video of that. Also, we had a fire on another UPS 747 where it was linked to batteries on board, lithium ion batteries, which, as it happens, were also the kinds of batteries causing issues for the Dreamliner. So I think in terms of, you know, security and safety, it seems that there may need to be a look at just what they're carrying in terms of its volatility, but also how they're securing it on the airplane. So that could be issues here. We just do not know yet. It's still too early, and the black boxes have yet to be recovered. They're said to be in smoldering wreckage at this point, although they are hopeful that they will find the black boxes.
Well, we'll certainly keep our eyes on that investigation as it unfolds and look at any wider developments for the industry itself as it comes forward. Now we'll move from the skies, Tristan, to the tracks, and it's been a bumper month for Amtrak.
Yeah, it's been a great month for Amtrak, and this is something I love to see. I love rail. I think it's such a great thing in the U.S., not nearly as popular as say, air travel, not nearly as popular as rail elsewhere in the world. But we're seeing on some of the major arterial routes with Amtrak a huge bump in July ridership, 4.8% more in July of this year than last year. That's around 3 million people total. And it's against the backdrop of a lot of other things which could have caused this. There's issues with gas prices, people moving around by car just isn't as viable as it once was. Just the question over what gas prices might be when you get on the road. And then also beyond that, there's all this airline industry upheaval. And then of course, airfares this summer seem astronomically high, at least anecdotally. So, and then even beyond that too, we have things like Elon Musk's talk of mass transit projects like the Hyperloop. So all these things sort of swirling to sort of either come in and affect the market, and still we're seeing a very strong turnout for trains this last month, which is great. And they're expecting that it will continue through the year, which could lead to one of the biggest years that Amtrak's, or the biggest year that Amtrak's ever had.
Well, that is fantastic news. And you're speaking to someone who spent a month on Amtrak trains back in March, and it was an absolutely fantastic time. There's plenty of leg space, the dining facilities are quite good, and you go from, you know, state to state, you go to the scenery is completely different from one end to the next, and it was absolutely great. But many of the Americans who you speak to, they were first-time train travellers, and they all had various reasons for going there, either moving home or seeing a new baby born in another state. And it was kind of an adventure for everyone you spoke to, American or not.
And that's what I was going to tell you. It's very interesting. You are a very good example of this. Is many of the people who've ridden across the country or ridden extensively on Amtrak are not Americans, at least the ones that I know. I mean, it seems that people from especially Europe are more willing to give the train a chance and willing to sort of take the time to see the country and do it that way. And I think for those who are willing, it's a very, very good means of transportation, and it's cost effective.
That was Tristan McAllister there with Thomas Lewis on this week's Top Transport Stories.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll preview this week's edition of The Menu, get the latest from our correspondent in Jerusalem, and we'll flip through the Italian newspapers with Monocle's David Pleasant here in the studio. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Egypt's military-backed interim government has said it's prepared to use force again today, with further protests expected after the crackdown on demonstrators earlier this week. Well over 600 people are known to have died when security forces moved to break up protest camps in Cairo, set up by supporters of Mohamed Morsi, the ousted president. The United Nations has called for maximum restraint. Indian Navy divers have found the bodies of two of the 18 sailors who were trapped in a submarine after an explosion and fire on board. There's been no sign of life since the explosion on Tuesday night, as the submarine was docked in Mumbai. Leaked documents suggest America's National Security Agency has broken privacy rules thousands of times in the past 5 years, subjecting U.S. citizens to unauthorized surveillance. The Washington Post has published details of an internal audit leaked by the whistleblower Edward Snowden, which shows the NSA decided not to report the accidental surveillance of phone calls in Washington. Prime Minister in Libya has said that he's prepared to use force to end protests by guards at the country's main oil ports. Ali Zaidan accuses them of trying to sell oil unofficially during their strike over pay. Ministers say Libya has lost more than $1.5 billion in oil revenue because of the dispute. And two senior managers at the New Zealand dairy giant Fonterra have been suspended. It's happened as inquiries continue into a contamination scandal. There are two investigations into how bacteria that can cause botulism got into infant formula, which was then sold to consumers. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove, and Phil Hahn. In this week's edition of The Menu, we visit the tea rooms of Berlin, meet the duo behind the gastronomy magazine Fool, and speak to a businessman importing quality Argentinian wines to the UK.
I love Argentinian wine. Are you a fan of Argentinian wine?
Big fan of a Malbec.
Are you?
Yes, I'm tuning in.
But it's quite understated, isn't it? It's, you know, doesn't have that kind of same sex appeal as you know, another kind of wine.
Well, I think it does. I've actually been on a wine tour of Argentina, Mendoza. So I think you're talking to an expert, frankly.
Well, actually, I met a winery, a winemaker, and he grows wine, but it's in the most steep of hills in Argentina. So they actually have to use like acrobats on ropes to collect them.
Oh, wow. The circus troupe.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating.
That is that's a dexterous workforce.
It is. I wonder if it makes the wine taste any better.
I'm sure it does.
Well, we're going to be leaving Argentina and heading over to Germany because in this preview, we're going to be visiting Berlin. It's a city that oozes sex appeal, except when it comes to its dusty fine dining scene. Well, that is until now. Tommy Tanek goes to meet a pair of energetic young Canadians who are hoping to shake things up with their private dining concept.
One of today's prevalent media narratives is that of the lost generation. A future where millions of youngsters are trapped in a vicious cycle of joblessness and parental dependency. I've travelled westwards to Mirbit, a downbeat residential neighbourhood, to meet someone swimming against the current.
It's a golden evening here on Turmstrasse, and we are making our way down what seems to be a very average high street towards Junggrunnenblau.
We're met at the door by Sam, a fresh-faced Canadian, who is the business half of this unusual dining project. From a clankety lift, we emerge into a large, light-filled room. Getting some air at the large windows is a mixed group exchanging the usual small talk of strangers. A German TV star, film director, and a banker-doctor couple celebrating their anniversary. There is a tasteful table set for six, a countertop kitchen behind it, and about as many staff as guests. On paper, Junggrunnenblau may sound like a glorified supper club. However, it's executed with the finesse of a trained hand. Six guests per evening are served 18 micro-courses of locally sourced produce, paired with wines. Here's the chef, Dylan Watson, explaining one of the dishes.
Chips fried in a mixture of canola and sesame oil, and underneath you have a bit of sour butter.
Buttered potatoes are raised from the prosaic to something marvellous. Purity is there in many forms. A tart goat's milk is frozen into snow and cut with salted cherries. A few punchy chanterelle tips bob about in a clear duck broth. Japanese influences too shine through, with his use of miso or the quiveringly set egg custard of chawanmushi. After the meal, I got a chance to ask Dylan why Japanese cooking matters to him.
We use some ingredients, but we also like, the philosophy runs all the way through the cooking, almost in every dish. We want simplicity, we want a focus on a particular theme or ingredient. And we don't want overcrowding, and the focus is on the meat and the technique you use. You shouldn't be hiding behind other things. Yeah, perhaps the sauce can enhance the flavor of the meat, but not necessarily. You know, it's about choosing the right technique for the right product, and that's very Japanese.
This idea is most ably demonstrated in the final and only meat course. A lone breast of wild duck is cryo-rendered, one of the many techniques developed by Nathan Meerwald, author of the gargantuan molecular bible Modernist Cuisine. The breast is frozen flat with dry ice, so as to act as a barrier for the skin to be perfectly rendered without overcooking any flesh. It is then dramatically smoked over hay on the kitchen counter, and served sliced with a simple pinch of salt in the middle of the plate. This robust confidence with technique perhaps belies Dylan's age of just 19, something that's caused quite a stir among Berlin's food press. Dylan himself takes a sanguine view on age.
It's about empowering other young people as well, because like, you're 20 years old, like we could make a mistake, nobody could have come, and you know, like you don't have a house, you don't have a car, you don't have expenses,
you don't have children.
Exactly. So it's just like the best piece of advice I ever got was make mistakes and make them when you're young.
He's certainly taken good heed of this advice. At the age of 17, he realized that school wasn't getting him anywhere, and his dentist father was unusually sympathetic. He offered to sponsor Dylan's training, and things took off in Japan in 3-star Michelin style.
I went to a great restaurant called Ryugen. Thought the food was like the best thing I've ever had. Well, after dinner, the chef came out in the Japanese fashion. I said, I want to come work here. And they emailed me back, funny enough, after a month. And they said, you want to come? And I came. And then after a month working there, they asked me how old I was. And I said, 17. They lost their mind.
Not ruffled, but energized by outsider status. I was curious to hear what Dylan thinks about Berlin's restaurant scene.
I don't want to like step on any toes. I mean, I've tried a few Michelin-starred restaurants in Berlin, and without naming names or saying anything, overall, I've been extremely disappointed in the quality and the ideology, the ambience. Berlin has ended up being the end point for a lot of trends and ideas, and you have people who are totally recycling old ideas on a city that's naive when it comes to diners and people with money who don't necessarily have the experience to say that this is I'm not going to say a fraudulent experience, but it's lacking in creativity, and people are passing off ideas that they think are theirs.
Dylan may have already had internships in some of the biggest name kitchens in the world, Noma, 11 Madison Park and Passé, but his ideas seem remarkably self-determined. The painstaking attention to detail is what most impresses, from the custom-made plateware and the menu typography based on U-Bahn station names, to the demands they place on local growers to provide the ingredients they need. Here's Sam.
It took a long time to convince the lovely lady who grows her carrots, Sybil, to convince her to pick the carrots out of the ground when they were babies, just because, of course, they'll yield far less, being a third of the size. And we weren't successful convincing other farmers to do the same thing.
It can often take an outside perspective to look afresh at what's right under your nose. And Dylan and Sam are doing this with both charm and poise. The city is certainly hungry for it too. They are booked out until October. For Monocle, in Berlin, I'm Tommy Tanak.
Yum, yum. Have you ever had Cairo frozen rabbit?
No, I
baked
haven't.
Over hay. Smoked hay.
Oh, smoked hay. That was a flourish. I was surprised to hear. He is a youngster, isn't he?
How did he develop such tastes?
I know, he's getting around. Definitely one to watch on the Berlin scene. Although I have to say, I quite like just a classic currywurst.
Simple, yeah.
Or a hamburger from that lovely little hamburger joint,
yum,
in Kreuzberg underneath the Autobahn.
I'm very hungry. It's only 8:40 here in London, so you haven't had breakfast yet, have you?
No, I haven't.
If you could have, what would you have? Oh, I'm hungry.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a check-in with our man in Jerusalem.
Whether you're in Ankara or Abu Dhabi, start your day with The Globalist. We'll bring you the world in an hour with comment and analysis on the day's news and the business stories that will be shaping your day.
Banking was never one of the biggest problems in Portugal, even during the crisis.
This is over a decade. Does anybody really believe that the agreement that is reached, let's say even if we did it today, is going to stick for a decade? No one believes that.
And don't miss The Monologue, our editor's pithy, funny, or just brutally honest takes on the people and places making the headlines for all the right and wrong reasons.
You can be half sold on a deal if you find yourself happy and content to sit and wait in their lobby.
Could a Europe-wide TV service work? What would such a broadcast outfit even look like?
A friendly cab driver or a tasty breakfast is now an unexpected surprise. And when it comes to what happens on board, well, anything short of a derailment is bliss.
That's The Globalist on Monocle 24 every weekday at 6 a.m. London time. The Globalist is brought to you in association with GE.
You're listening to Midori House. Well, it's 8:42 here in London, and time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we head to Jerusalem to speak to our man then, Joseph Dana. Joseph, welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. Very good morning.
Good morning to you. Now, as we said earlier, quite a lot of international news is being eclipsed by the events in Egypt. But there's some significant talks taking place this week, second rounds of negotiations in Bethlehem. Give us an update on what's happening in that arena.
Absolutely. It's been an incredibly busy week here in the Middle East, actually. The week kind of began with all of these let's say, not muted hope for some sort of resolution between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Israel released a handful of Palestinian prisoners in a goodwill gesture that was very much received warmly in Ramallah. There was very big celebrations throughout the West Bank as these prisoners returned. And talks, which have been, you know, very elusive for the last, let's say, 3 years, did begin last night in Jerusalem on Wednesday evening in Jerusalem. So there's a kind of news blackout that is hanging over these talks. So we don't know exactly what was discussed, but Ban Ki-moon was here in Ramallah on the West Bank yesterday, and it looks like things are kind of slowly going forward. And I can assure you that both the Palestinians and the Israelis are probably looking at the events in Egypt and with a very kind of thankful eye that some of the news pressure has been taken off their situation as these talks kind of get going.
And of course, Joseph, these talks come just a few days after Israel has approved some 900 more settlement homes, despite protests from the Palestinians. Many people thought that perhaps the peace talks would be completely derailed by that announcement. What factor is that having in the talks?
Well, it's an exceptionally large factor. It's almost mind-boggling how Israel is able to take one of the central issues that the Palestinians have made in terms of going back to the table and just kind of exploiting it with these continued settlement announcements. The United States has had some kind of, let's say, veiled criticism saying that they strongly condemn renewed settlement activity. And in fact, John Kerry, in his public statements in the beginning of the week, reaffirmed the American position that these settlements are in fact legitimate. Now, this is a very, this is a very significant measure by the Americans to publicly say this, because the Israelis continuously kind of argue that these settlements have some sort of veiled legitimacy, and the Americans kind of go on board with them. So to have John Kerry publicly say that these are in fact illegitimate does send a certain message to all of the parties involved that the settlements are one of the most fundamental issues and are going to be the really difficult nut to crack in this peace process, if this peace process actually does get any sort of hold on the ground.
And Joseph, let's take a look at what's going on with Hamas in Gaza. They've been in a very peculiar situation over the last couple of months, losing money, but also really losing traction in some ways. Can you give us an insight into what's happening in the leadership there?
Yes, I think that Hamas is really one of the most important stories in the Middle East that's completely ignored and overshadowed by the events in Egypt. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood ostensibly had good relations with Hamas, or at least there was an idea that there would be good relations between Egypt and Hamas and Gaza. That didn't really play out, and the Egyptian military has come out against Hamas very forcefully in terms of closing the Rafah border between Gaza and Sinai, and in fact inciting against Hamas inside of Egypt, saying that Hamas operatives were responsible for some of the violence that the Muslim Brotherhood has been perpetrating there. Outside of that, Hamas has kind of seen its major regional players kind of dry up. Qatar has a new leadership, and so it's unclear whether or not Qatar is going to keep funding Hamas with its much, much needed cash. And Turkey the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan was supposed to visit the Gaza Strip in what would have been a major kind of diplomatic coup for Hamas, and that was canceled because the Egyptian military denied him access to the border in Rafah. And so Hamas is kind of languishing down in Gaza. Its money is running out. Its water is running out. And there's really growing anger on the streets of Gaza against Hamas. The prisoner release, which happened earlier this week, was a big, big kind of bolster for the Fatah leadership in the West Bank. And so Abbas has been able to kind of use that news and say, look, I am, you know, really running the Palestinian struggle, as it were, and I'm getting, you know, kind of concessions from Israel while Gaza has just been kind of sliced off and is floating as a kind of island somewhere in the Middle East. And so Hamas is going to be a very big story, whether or not they're going to be able to maintain power and whether or not they're going to be able to find any sort of new revenue streams. Otherwise, they're just going to run out of money, and it's going to be a very bad situation in Gaza.
Joseph, let's move on to a bit of a lighter story in the region. I'm not sure, are you much of an avid cyclist there in Jerusalem?
I am not an avid cyclist, but I am an avid runner, and so I try and, you know, find these very beautiful paths through these rolling mountains in the West Bank and around Jerusalem. And occasionally, I do see some cyclists around.
Well, there might be some good news for you then, if you want to get into cycling, because it looks like Jericho may be getting some bike lanes. How exciting!
Yeah, it's a kind of nice story for such a, you know, kind of desperate situation here on the West Bank. But it does look like the municipality of Jericho has hired who seems to be a very talented architect from a university near Nablus in the Northwest Bank to create Palestine's first bike lane. Now, Palestinians and, you know, I would say the Arab world in general, people like cars here. People like driving exceptionally fast for some reason. It's actually kind of funny because, you know, most people are late and yet they drive very, very fast to meetings. I've never been able to figure that out. And so in Jericho, they're going to try and put more bicyclists on the streets next to these crazy cars. And it's been welcomed with open arms by a lot of green activists on both sides of the wall, as it were. A lot of Israelis have been talking about how this is a good initiative and there needs to be more bike lanes in Israel as well.
Well, Joseph, as ever, fascinating to talk to you. That was Joseph Dana, Monocle's man in Jerusalem.
How funny would it be if you saw one of those Boris bikes, London's Boris bikes, down on that Jericho bike lane?
I think they should get quite a sight. System immediately.
It's a nice PR stunt though, isn't it? So Boris Johnson, if you're listening, take note. Well, it's time for us to get some music before we have a check through this morning's Italian front pages with the very Italian David Pleasant. But before all that, here is Annalisa, a singer from Liguria, with Lotto in Noi. And that was Annalisa there with Io Tu Inoi. I have a good pronunciation.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Sophie Grove, and Phil Hahn. Now, David Pleasant is here to flip through the morning's Italian newspapers, a man with some pronunciation under his belt.
I'm trying my best.
David, welcome to the studio. Tell us, let's kick off with a piece in Corriere della Sera looking at the road ahead for Mr. Berlusconi.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting piece in the Corriere. They basically analyse his options. Obviously, he was convicted of tax fraud at the beginning of the month. Now, they're looking quite in-depth at his various options. It's an interesting tale in terms of the Italian law, as complicated as that is. So it kind of goes through all the different options. Pardon is the first one. There was speculation that he had actually requested pardon from the President Giorgio Napolitano. That was unconfirmed, and the president said that he had never had a request for pardon. So that's just that. That's the first option. Some of his lawyers, of Berlusconi's lawyers, have said that he's more than likely to ask for a pardon. That's not seen as a very good political move by some. So that's the first option. The second option that they list is just decline. This story will kind of fizzle out. Berlusconi will step into the background, and that'll be the end of it. Doubtful somehow. I don't really believe that one. The next option is disqualification. So he will be disqualified from taking office. That's an ongoing issue for Berlusconi, and it's kind of the crux of the matter. Even more important probably than his actual punishment is this disqualification from taking office, especially within the upper house, the Senate.
And there seems to be a couple, Sophie, just a few things that his party may be doing to try to get back some of that pizzazz behind him. It looks like they're going to be heading to the beaches of Italy in the next couple of days. They're going to be heading to Sardinia, Liguria, Tuscany, the Amalfi Coast. They're going to be handing out pamphlets on the beach. Commentators have dubbed it the Freedom Tour. There's also another option where they're going to perhaps do something called the Sky Attack, which the El Giornale newspaper is reporting, where they're going to have large banners flying all across Italy.
Exactly. And here is some of that footage. The Forza Italia, they've actually relaunched the name of the party back to its 1990s name, Forza Italia, Go Italy. And this was a kind of iconic image of Italy during the 90s. The Forza Italia plane would kind of fly over the beaches. That's back this summer with many hundreds of beaches seeing that plane with that banner saying Forza Italia and Go Silvio as well.
I should say this has a very retro feel to it. Yeah. In the typography even. I mean, looking at sort of... It's very 30s.
I know, it's quite kind of charming somehow.
It's charming. But it's very interesting to sort of see how that repositioning of the party is taking place while there's so much chaos going around, surrounding this defeat. definitive conviction for tax fraud.
Exactly. It's quite extraordinary, really, that they've chosen to go back to the name of the party that was so connected to Berlusconi. I think that in these few weeks, and many commentators have been saying that they're really going to thrash out the future for the centre-right within Italy. Interestingly, if I finish on that kind of analysis of Berlusconi's options, this journalist is saying that actually the option of taking the social service, the community service option for Berlusconi might be a really wise one. The best thing about that option is that under Italian law, those criminals who do community service basically blank out, eliminate the effects of their criminal conviction, therefore allowing him not only to serve in the Senate, but also as a parliamentarian. So he could actually go back to being prime minister if he did community service, which is quite an interesting option.
That option might also be the most humiliating as well, though, no?
Exactly. And
imagine him in a little orange jumpsuit or something on the side of the road, picking up garbage.
And some of the options are listed, including drug rehabilitation centres, and so on. So it's an unlikely option for the former prime minister.
And very quickly, how is austerity? What's happening with austerity when it comes to a summer festival there in Italy?
This is a report in ANSA, the news agency, Italian news agency. Austerity spells a low-key Ferragosto for Italians, is the headline. And Ferragosto, obviously, clearly is the mid-August festival that happens across Italy. It was actually yesterday is the date. It says that many less Italians will be heading to the pizzerias and restaurants, which is the traditional thing to do on Ferragosto, is basically spending the whole day in a restaurant. It's all about picnics this year and barbecues at the beach.
Well, David Pleasant, as ever, great to speak to you. That was David Pleasant with the Italian newspapers.
Unfortunately, though, that is all the time we have for today's programme. Thanks to our producer, Danny Giacopelli. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elias Simos. And our studio manager was Chris Fitch.
Up next, after the news, is our weekly design show, Section D. Midori House will be back at the same time on Monday. But until then...
From me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Sophie Grove.
We're going to say goodbye. Bye-bye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.